The World and Everything in It is brought to you by listeners like us. My name is Tom Arneberg, and I'm a chip design engineer from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. I'm the husband of one, the father of five, the scoutmaster of dozens, and the church elder to hundreds over most of the last 25 years. And I've never missed a World podcast. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Efforts to contain the coronavirus are helping slow its spread. Today, we'll survey what several states are doing.
We want to do all we can to prevent this virus from affecting those communities who are most at risk from it.
Also today, we'll talk with a doctor about what social distancing means in practical terms. Plus, World's reporters in the field tell us what travel is like during this pandemic.
Tuesday, March 17th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Up next, Ken Covington with today's news.
Authorities in the San Francisco Bay Area are placing six counties on lockdown, issuing shelter-in-place orders for nearly 7 million residents. Effective today, officials are prohibiting non-essential travel and they're closing down non-essential businesses. Santa Clara Health Officer Dr. Sarah Cody emphasized that pharmacies and grocery stores will remain open.
Food can be ordered from restaurants or delivery or carryout. Gas stations, banks, and hardware stores will remain open. And essential government services and essential infrastructure will continue to operate.
There are nearly 300 cases of COVID-19 in the Bay Area. Cody said Santa Clara County is the epicenter of the outbreak, and health officials determined the area is reaching a tipping point. The shelter-in-place order is the strongest measure yet within the United States, but an increasing number of states and cities have begun to tighten restrictions, such as shutting down dine-in restaurants and bars. And in another sign of COVID-19's impact on the nation, the Supreme Court on Monday postponed oral arguments. That marks the first time the court has delayed arguments over a public health matter since the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. President Trump and other top officials again briefed reporters at the White House Monday about the national response to the virus.
I want to thank everybody for being here today.
The president said in an effort to get ahead of the curve, his administration is announcing new guidelines to help slow the spread of the virus.
My administration is recommending that all Americans, including the young and healthy, work to engage in schooling from home when possible, avoid gathering in groups of more than 10 people, avoid discretionary travel, and avoid eating and drinking at bars, restaurants, and public food courts.
The president also conceded that the country could be slipping into a coronavirus recession, but he said his focus right now is on halting the virus. He also speculated that the worst of the coronavirus impact could last until July or August. That likely contributed to another horrendous day on Wall Street, which again had its worst day since 1987. The Dow plummeted 3,000 points despite the Fed's efforts on Sunday to calm the markets. The coronavirus relief bill just passed by the House faces an uncertain future in the Senate. Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas said he doesn't think the House bill will pass in the upper chamber.
It doesn't go far enough. It doesn't cover enough workers and their families. It doesn't do enough to make sure that we eliminate any financial incentive that anyone may have to be at work or other public places because they're worried about buying groceries or making the car payment or paying the rent.
The House bill passed with overwhelming bipartisan support over the weekend. It would expand access to free testing, extend sick leave benefits, and provide $1 billion in food aid. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is calling for a comprehensive aid package. He said it should contain significant steps to help families and businesses as workplaces shutter, schools send students home, and health systems brace to provide emergency care. For now, the Senate is stalled, waiting on the House to send its package of sick pay and other resources. That was approved early Saturday with President Trump's support, but quickly became tangled in technical issues. The package comes on top of the $8.3 billion in initial aid approved at the start of the month, but all sides, House, Senate, and the White House, say it's not nearly enough to handle what's coming. A COVID-19 vaccine trial is now underway, while scientists also rush to find an effective treatment for the disease. World Radio's Anna Johansson has more.
The first participants in a clinical vaccine trial have received an experimental dose at a research institute in Washington state. But officials caution that it will likely take a year to 18 months to fully validate any potential vaccine. The National Institutes of Health is funding the trial, which started Monday at the Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute in Seattle. Meantime, scientists are also racing to find an effective treatment for COVID-19. They hope to reduce the duration and severity of the disease. Among the possibilities, Gilead Sciences is testing its antiviral drug remdesivir, which has shown promise against other viruses, including one type of coronavirus. And Johnson & Johnson is testing its HIV drug darunavir. It cited unpublished virological and clinical data that showed some effectiveness in treating the SARS coronavirus. But it's still too early to know if those or any other possible treatments could be effective against COVID-19. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson.
At least 71 people have now died from the coronavirus in the United States, and there are at least 3,700 confirmed cases. But with problems in access to testing, experts fear the virus is much more widespread than those numbers indicate. Ohio's top health official has halted the state's presidential primary over concerns about the coronavirus just hours before voting was set to begin today. On Monday, Governor Mike DeWine tried to persuade a judge to delay in-person voting until June. He noted recent CDC guidelines warning against any gatherings of more than 50 people.
It is clear that tomorrow's in-person voting does not conform and cannot conform with these CDC guidelines.
But Ohio Judge Richard Fry said it's too late to delay the vote, and he added that there's no evidence to suggest it will be safer to vote in June. But then the state's top health official, Dr. Amy Acton, stepped in and issued the order to close polling stations. She said crowds gathering at those polling places today could put people at unacceptable risk. But officials in three other states scheduled to vote today felt they had done enough to ensure the safety of voters. So elections will go forward in Arizona, Florida, and Illinois. However, officials in those states have closed down some voting stations and relocated others for safety reasons. But another state will postpone its election until June. Kentucky's Secretary of State Michael Adams made the announcement last night.
Today, Governor Beshear and I agreed to delay the primary election originally scheduled for May 19th to June 23rd.
Kentucky joins Georgia and Louisiana as the third state to postpone its primary election. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, the varied approaches states are taking to curtail the coronavirus, plus our reporters recount their travel experiences. This is The World and Everything in It.
It is Tuesday, the 17th of March, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Last week, President Trump declared a national emergency over the coronavirus pandemic. That move allocates federal aid up to $50 billion to help states fight back. Bureaucratic restrictions are loosened so that healthcare providers can do what they need to do.
Over the last 2 weeks, nearly every governor in the country has declared a state of emergency at the local level. That means state officials can set curfews, mandate quarantines, and cancel public gatherings. World reporter Paul Butler has a story now on the different state responses to the COVID-19 health crisis.
When President Trump declared the national state of emergency on Friday, a handful of states had already issued emergency proclamations, giving them legal standing to make a wide range of executive decisions regarding public safety and health. The nation's first confirmed case of COVID-19 occurred in Washington state on January 20th. 5 weeks later, a man died in King County, Washington, becoming the first U.S. death related to the virus. That same day, Governor Jay Inslee declared a state of emergency.
You don't have to be a senator or a governor or a president. Everyone can be a leader in this effort.
And within days, other states quickly followed suit, including California, Maryland, Utah, Pennsylvania, and on March 6th, Kentucky. Governor Andy Beshear.
While the overall threat to Kentuckians is still low, we as a state are going to take every necessary action to protect our people. So about 5 minutes ago, I filed a state of emergency.
As of yesterday, every state but West Virginia had reported at least one case of the virus. Early on, most states began by issuing guidelines for voluntary quarantines, social distancing, and minimizing exposure by restricting group activities. Here's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on March 8th.
We are trying to contain the spread of the virus. Basically, we want to reduce as much as possible situations creating density.
Large churches around the country responded by canceling services or moving them online. Collegiate and professional sports teams closed their stadiums to the public. Couples began canceling weddings, and families delayed funerals. What began as voluntary compliance in some states soon became mandatory. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf from March 12.
In Montgomery County, I am ordering the closure of all schools, community centers, gyms, and entertainment venues. This includes Y's, theaters, sporting events, concerts, and I am strongly recommending the closure of non-essential retail facilities.
Hoboken, New Jersey Mayor Steve Fulop took it a step further, ordering people off the streets by 10 p.m.
Well, we're going to put a curfew essentially in place in the larger nightclubs, to be perfectly clear. So
by the end of last week, most states had either extended spring break or canceled school until at least the end of March. Here's Alabama Governor Kay Ivey speaking Friday.
All public K through 12 schools across the state will have a 2.5 week break.
Most state universities are moving to online learning for the next few weeks. Some have even canceled the rest of the semester. But as COVID-19 is most dangerous for older patients, many governors, including Florida's Ron DeSantis, have introduced restrictions for visiting nursing homes and other care facilities.
At the end of the day, this is a virus that does not threaten all segments of our society equally. The folks who are most at risk for this are folks who are elderly, frail, or have a serious underlying medical condition. So we want to do all we can to prevent this virus from affecting those communities who are at most at risk from it.
State officials continue to issue new guidelines almost daily in response to the virus. The rapidly changing restrictions are proving confusing for some residents. Others seem unwilling to change, seeing the state provisions as overreactions. On Saturday, North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper was visibly frustrated by the many not taking the guidelines seriously.
As you know, we issued this as guidance on Thursday. However, despite this guidance, several venues continued their events. So today's order makes it mandatory. This is a risk we cannot tolerate.
Many states like Massachusetts, Nevada, and Illinois have prohibited eating in public. With Trump's suggestion yesterday for limiting groups to 10 people or less, and California's shelter-in-place edict for some of their counties, it's likely that many other local governments will follow their lead in the days ahead. In the midst of it all, Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon encouraged his state residents to think of others in very practical ways in the days and weeks ahead.
I am also receiving concerns from our communities that there are a lack of cleaning supplies and sanitizer and toilet paper. I ask that you be respectful of others in your community when you are stocking up. Some of our most vulnerable residents are unable to get into our communities and must rely on others to bring supplies.
Reporting for World, I'm Paul Butler.
Additional support comes from PNR Publishing, 31-day devotionals for life, providing help for struggles with porn addiction, anger, anxiety, and more. PRPBooks.com. And from Maranatha Baptist University, flexible, biblical, engaging online options from high school to graduate school, mbu.edu.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, social distancing. Now, we're hearing that phrase quite a lot, but what does it mean in practical terms? What distance is far enough? What works? What doesn't? Joining us now to explain is Dr. Charles Horton. He's a physician in Pittsburgh.
Good morning, Dr. Horton. Now, this new term describes something so serious that it can be a matter of life and death. So can you define social distancing and give us some examples of the best way to practice it?
Sure. Social distancing means putting space between you and other people to slow down the spread of disease. Now, normally people are very social. It's how God made us. I like eating out with my friends more than I like eating out by myself. But now we're being asked to consciously avoid group events or even prevent them for a while to slow down the spread of disease. One excellent example of leadership in that area is actually what the sports leagues have done. They've decided to put the public's health ahead of their ticket sales and not have crowds sitting close together. That's social distancing. Closing schools, closing restaurants, canceling or delaying cultural events until after things settle down, and working from home whenever you can.
I'm wondering, can you go too far with this? I mean, maybe some people are doing things they believe are social distancing, but maybe they really aren't.
I'll give a lawyer's answer. It depends. If you completely isolate yourself from the world, you won't get coronavirus. Now, Gunnison, Colorado actually did this with the Spanish flu in 1918. Officials there barricaded the roads for 2 months, and nobody in Gunnison died from Spanish flu. So for certain vulnerable people, trying to have the absolute lowest chance of exposure is worth it. The danger does go up sharply with age, and ditto if you're in poor health. Your average teenager is going to shrug this off, but your patient with iffy lungs from smoking a pack a day won't. That's the main idea behind social distancing. We're trying to make it harder for the virus to spread from person to person and keep it from infecting the people who would be hard hit. What about grandma who's visiting the grandkids who aren't in school because the school was closed? That could well protect grandma because the children don't have coronavirus. As far as things that don't help, for example, I was reading about people going to crowded bars for St. Patrick's Day parties and saying, well, I'll be okay because I brought hand sanitizer. If anyone in the bar is sick, that's probably not enough.
Mm. We're hearing a lot about flattening the curve. Can you explain that in simple terms?
When we talk about a curve, an epidemic curve, or sometimes we say epi curve, we mean how many new cases show up per day. Lots of factors feed into that. There are some we can control and some we can't, because some bugs are just more contagious than others. They all do have one thing in common, which is that they all have to get from one person to another or they won't spread. So the faster a bug spreads, the steeper the curve tends to be. The slower it spreads, the flatter the curve. The curve will always tail off after a while, even if people don't do anything at all, because it simply runs out of people to infect. Mm-hmm. Let's think about something happier than actual viruses for a moment. Think of something going viral on the internet. You know, the video where the guy's two-year-old barges into the room while he's giving a live interview on TV. If you looked at how many people had watched the video, at first it's going up really quickly. Everyone's forwarding it to their friends. Nobody's seen it before. Hey, you've got to check this out. After a while, it tails off because more and more people have already seen it. Real viruses act the same way. Right now, we're trying to keep the curve as flat as possible, making the disease spread as slowly as possible. The goal is to keep our hospitals from being overrun like they had been in Wuhan, like they are now in Italy, like we're starting to see in Seattle.
You know, last night, Dr. Horton, I was at the grocery store and a young woman was expressing exasperation that people were panicking and, you know, she wasn't going to die, so what's the big deal? What do you say to that kind of naivete?
I would remind her that even if she isn't in much danger, she could carry the virus to people who are. And the situation we're really concerned about getting into is simply running out of ventilators. What if people would survive with the help of a ventilator and ICU care, but there's no ventilator or there's no ICU bed? That's the situation we're trying to avoid. And that's the reason for these kind of extreme seeming measures. They're worth it. This is not a dress rehearsal.
Any final tips for us, Dr. Horton?
Again, social distancing. Do clean things that we touch a lot, refrigerator doors, doorknobs, cash, cell phones. Do cough and sneeze into your sleeve. If you've seen one of those pictures where someone takes a flash photograph of a sneeze or a cough, it's amazing how far the respiratory droplets go. It's about 6 feet, then gravity takes over. So if you have to be out and about, then keep that 6 foot mark in mind.
Anybody who's seen that picture would never forget it. Dr. Charles Horton is a practicing physician in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dr. Horton, thanks for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure. Stay calm. Stay well.
Well, you have no doubt noticed certain items in shorter supply these days on the store shelves. Paper products, for example, like, you know, what you need every single day in the restroom.
Yep.
Well, the owner of an arcade in East Yorkshire, England, has found a clever way to help ease the shortage of toilet paper. So what you have to picture here is one of those big coin-operated crane machines, you know, like the big metal claw that you maneuver to pick out your desired toy and pick it up and drop it in the bin so you can take it home. But what this arcade owner did was to pull all the novelties out and replace them instead with necessities, that is to say, rolls of toilet paper. Then he set his machine outside on the sidewalk. Another arcade operator did pretty much the same. He said he evicted the character from Frozen and the Peter Rabbit teddy bears and replaced them with hand sanitizer and toilet rolls instead. Apparently, the new crane prizes have been a huge success and given people not only a welcome and fun diversion, but it's also taken care of a real need.
Nice.
It's the world and everything in it. Today is Tuesday, March 17th. You're listening to World Radio, and we are glad you are. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Riker. Well, it may be St. Patrick's Day, but those celebrations have come to a screeching halt. No massive parades. Instead, canceled events of all sorts. To get an idea of what some of these effects are like firsthand, we are joined now by three world reporters who've been out and about during these disruptions. First up is Sarah Schweinsberg. Now, Sarah, last week you were on a reporting trip in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that area really came into the headlines last week because a cruise ship docked in the port of Oakland with at least 21 coronavirus cases on board. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Mary, it was interesting driving north straight out of downtown San Francisco, driving across a bridge there. I looked to my right, and there is the 2,400-passenger Grand Princess cruise ship anchored there. And I think with that ship being anchored there, it led a lot of Silicon Valley companies like Twitter, Amazon, Facebook, Airbnb to ask their employees to work from home, which really cut back on the traffic in the area, which was nice for me. But it's difficult for some employees who do rely on that heavy traffic downtown for their cafes and shops. And now yesterday, as you heard earlier, authorities have banned non-essential gatherings of any size there, and they're asking people to only go out in public for the essentials. So things have really changed there in just 1 week.
What was flying like in the midst of a lot of these disruptions to everyday life?
To me, traffic in the airport was a lot less dense than it usually is. You know, usually you're wheeling down the hall and you have to weave and zag around people to walk in a straight line. And that was not a problem at all. And then I was on my way to another city and another conference over the weekend, and route to the airport, my conference got canceled. There was a lot of confusion over how to change and cancel flights. Could I get flight credit? Would I be reimbursed? Thankfully, I canceled my flight and I was reimbursed. Now, every airline's a little bit different. Forbes has put together a master list of all airlines and their cancellation flight change policies right now. That's really helpful to know how to best handle your situation, whatever that looks like. And I think we're going to link it here. So check the transcript later and you can look at that list.
All right. Thank you, Sarah, for that. Okay, let's toss it now to Lee Jones, who just got back from a family vacation to Disneyland. That's in California. Lee, it seems like you made it into and out of the park just in time for it to close Friday night through the end of this month. This marks only the fourth time the park has ever closed. So, Lee, going into last week, did you have any worries that the park could close while you were there?
Well, not before we left, but certainly by the time we got there, we were getting more alerts on our phones about all the other things that were closing and the things that were being postponed. And so I think, though, our bigger concern was whether we would be able to get home, because we kept, you know, seeing news alerts about the possibility for travel bans and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what did you observe in other guests and how they responded to the coronavirus throughout the week?
By the end of the week, we started to see more face masks, and the park was definitely, the traffic was lighter on Friday, but for the most part, it was sort of like being in another world. I mean, we were in lines with people. We were on rides with people. The princesses were all out in the park and welcoming kids. There was no social distancing or anything like that.
Well, things have certainly changed. And you were traveling with your six-year-old daughter, right? How did you explain all of this to her?
We've just been very honest about the fact that it's a bad sickness and it's affecting a lot of people. We're keeping her away from her grandmother for a couple of weeks because it's possible that we picked up the virus while we were traveling. And so we've just really tried to remind her that the coronavirus is new to us, but it's not news to God. And just using this as a real object lesson and trust.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're glad you're home safe and sound now. Take care out there. Finally, we're going to turn now to Emily Belz, who's traveled quite far all the way to Kenya to report on medical mission efforts there. She's currently in a mission hospital about 150 miles west of the capital city of Nairobi. Emily, for a long time, Africa didn't see a large spread of COVID-19, but those numbers are starting to grow. 25 countries now reporting cases. Kenya just confirming its first case on Friday. Are you seeing the hospital preparing for a possible spike in cases where you are?
It's really changing hourly here. The hospital has set up an isolation area. Even today at the hospital, they've had to cancel events. There was a free cervical cancer screening that was going to take place, and the government canceled it because more than 500 women were going to show up. A few days ago, we had a meeting with the entire hospital staff, which is about 800 people, and the CEO went over some of the basic things that they're trying to do. But then he prayed for everyone. He prayed that the people at the hospital, the staff, would be prepared to help the people of Kenya.
Mm-hmm. Are people in the community there worried about the virus, or does it still seem like it's a faraway problem at this point?
Even though there are no confirmed cases in this particular area, people are still using a lot of hand sanitizer. The hospital is going through a lot of masks. And we're seeing ripple effects already. So this weekend, we found out that a surgical team, a pediatric cardiothoracic surgical team that was supposed to come here canceled their trip. And they would have done a lot of cases for these babies with congenital heart defects. And so that's really devastating. So some of those babies are going to die because of travel restrictions. But I would also say that I've seen a lot of resilience from the healthcare workers here. And I think, you know, part of that is that Africa has faced a lot of new emerging viruses before. I think that for many of the workers here at this hospital, that goes back to their Christian faith and believing that they're here to serve and to sacrifice. And so I've been seeing that every day here.
Many African countries' healthcare systems aren't quite as advanced as those in the West or even in China and South Korea. Can healthcare systems there handle a pandemic spread of a virus like COVID-19? Do you see doctors and public officials worried?
I'm at Tenwick Hospital. They have a very high level of medical care here, actually, but they are busting at the seams. They just don't have any margin for a pandemic to happen. I don't know where they would put people, honestly. It's just full to the seams here.
Emily Belz at a missions hospital in rural Kenya. Thanks so much, Emily. Since we recorded this interview, the president of Kenya has closed the country's borders to all non-residents trying to enter, and the government has ordered anyone who recently entered the country to self-quarantine. So our Emily Belz will be in quarantine until the end of the week. We will keep you updated on her situation.
Today is Tuesday, March 17th. Good morning to you. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. For most people, the coronavirus is as inconvenient as having a cold or flu, but senior citizens are much more vulnerable. That's why social distancing is so important, as Dr. Horton described just a few minutes ago. Yet protecting older people is not the only reason to do this. Here is World's Les Sillars.
So these are my coronavirus gloves, and I wear them when I go out. And I disinfect these with disinfectant wipes, and that way I'm...
This is Mike Thomas. Like me, he's an elder at Fellowship Bible Church in Winchester. His gloves are tight-fitting, blue and black.
Just something to keep me mindful of social distancing.
What kind of gloves are they?
They're mechanic gloves, actually, from Walmart. So, nothing special, but they do have the... things in the fingertips so you can operate your smartphone.
I first saw Mike's gloves after an elders meeting last week. We'd been discussing what to do about the virus. We were taking it seriously, but, you know, nobody wanted to panic or anything. Then Mike spoke up. He explained about his new grandson, Seth.
It hits home for us a little bit in that we have a newborn grandson who was 2 months premature, born in October, and one of the conditions or problems with preemies is that they have inadequate lung development.
That leaves Seth seriously vulnerable to lung diseases like COVID-19. He's also a Down syndrome baby, and that makes it worse. Mike and his wife Donna babysit Seth's older sister Clara most days. They can't let her take any diseases back home, so they disinfect. A lot. They even change clothes more often. They stopped going to the playground. Here's Donna.
I've always thought, I guess I do a reasonable amount of hand washing, but now I do so much more because it's clear to me that my reasonable wasn't really effective. So, yeah.
You'd think that Mike and Donna would do anything to stop the spread of the virus. It could be life and death for Seth. And they are cautious. Our church has canceled events and put services online. But Mike and Donna also believe church members should help sick neighbors where possible. We should give generously so the church can help those in need. Mike and Donna reminded me that Christ is with us, always. So, sometimes loving your neighbor means staying home with Lysol wipes. And sometimes it means looking for ways, prudently, to minister to people next door.
So, let's walk around with that assurance and that confidence and minister to people. That's what we're asking our folks to do, is to really lean in to the situation and look around and see how we can help others.
I'm Les Sillars.
Tomorrow, World's Mindy Bells joins us to talk about the international response to COVID-19, and we will share some ideas on entertaining kids during this time. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The World and Everything in It comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Psalms remind us that God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Go now in grace and peace.